Thank you, Richard. Welcome to Waterloo, everyone. Thank you. Thank you for accepting each other. Save me the trouble. So I'm delighted to be here to chat with you all about cosmology. So let's write that down. Cosmology. So this. Do people near know what kind of you learned this yet? So that's generally right. So cosmology, I like to say that is a study of the universe as a whole, which is sort of like studying everything. It's kind of fun. But
so before I go into that, I kind of would say a few things that I haven't always been about long.
I'm originally from the U.S. I'm from if that's the U.S. I'm from Louisiana, which is the boot-shaped state. It's sort of by Texas.
It's a little state.
What? It's little, but great. So and of course, since I'm from the U.S., I pretty much see the world as the United States and then nothing else. Not true. That's not true at all. It's not true about me or most people from the United States, but it makes sometimes for a funny joke. There's Mexico. And there's Canada. Right. There's the North Pole here, right in the middle of Canada. And Richard said that I was a graduate student at Cornell University, which is really not very far from here in New York State. It's my really bad drawing of New York. It's Long Island, though. So I came from a place of perpetual summers and heat to places with lots of snow. So not right now. It's really beautiful right now. How long have y'all been here?
In
10 days. 10 days. And how many more days do you have? Great. Right. So Waterloo is often this lovely for several weeks a year. the winter is really not that bad. It is miserable and horrible, but people generally don't try to kill themselves as a result. So what about this group? So y'all are from everywhere in the world, I take it? So. Where's everywhere? Does anybody want to volunteer? Some people who are
Canada.
Turkey.
Where? Turkey.
Yeah. Okay.
Croatia.
Spain.
Singapore. Okay.
Slovakia.
Sorry.
Spain.
Slovakia. South Africa.
Finland.
Wait. You're Finland. Okay.
India.
Wow, okay. That is a bribe.
Ireland.
Yeah. My parents just got back from going to Ireland. They were very impressed. And they also almost died trying to drive, which apparently... So I didn't know this, but apparently Ireland is like the most dangerous place to drive in the world. And I think they learned later that, in fact, their insurance, they thought their auto insurance... Apparently it's so dangerous to drive there that, in fact... Your insurance company from anywhere else says, "Oh, you're in Ireland." No. But so that's all very interesting. That's really more geography. So I'm fascinated to know where you all are from. And I hope you're liking this day. I got interested in cosmology really when I was in graduate school. Before that, I was an undergraduate at a very small state school in Louisiana where my parents teach. Where the physics department consisted of three faculty, two of whom were old and cranky, and one of all of whom was old and not cranky. So, somehow I managed to get into this very, very good graduate program and found a not that old but cranky advisor. And so I hope that I'm neither old nor cranky at the moment. Anyway, so study of the universe as a whole. But before I get into talking about, so I had this particular subject that I was sort of preparing to talk about. But first, I wanted to sort of see if you had any burning questions that you wanted to have answered about the cosmos, outer space, the universe. And this is a little bit harder of a question than where you're from, but it shouldn't be that much harder. So, I mean, it seems like some of you struggled even to answer that first question. Yo.
Is there only one universe?
I'm sorry?
Is there only one universe?
Is there only one universe? It's a very good question. So the unit in universe shows that, at least in our
language, the
original idea about what universe meant was that it was that thing of which there is only one. So so if you go with that definition, then by definition the universe is only one. So but that's not usually what cosmologists mean by universe anymore. It's usually what cosmologists mean. I'll get your question, but so you don't have to keep your hand up. So I'll remember. I hope. So if I don't, you can yell at me. So universe, what cosmologists usually mean by universe is actually so one region where you that an observer can see. In which case, under that definition, we expect that the universe that we see is not the only, so we can see a certain amount of, so if the universe has a finite age, so if the universe were 5 minutes old, let's say, then if you look that way,
light
has a chance to come 5 minutes towards you, right? And so everything you could see would be that, however big that is, however big that sphere is, right? So then you could ask, but you know, if you wait 5 more minutes, you expect to keep seeing more stuff, right? And so then you can say, well, what defines the universe? Is it everything that I will ever see? Is it everything I've seen up till now? Or is it everything there is to see? But then you get to this hard definitional question, which is, what if, should the, what the universe is
trying to be based on when you are and
where you are and what you can see. All of which is to say that your question is an excellent one, and the answer to it depends on your answer to all these secondary questions about what you mean by it. And so the answer, so the final answer is that we don't really know.
That's what we can't see.
All we can see is one universe, but that doesn't really tell us a heck of a lot about the existence of places we can't see. Though,
so
people like to speculate about whether there are places that we can't see that nonetheless exist and go about their universe-type lives without ever
directly
attaching
them.
Does that? One of these non-answer types of answers, but it's actually really a clear question because a lot of people like to talk about multiverses or having lots of extra universes. But that's usually just a postulate to try to get to some answer. So we can talk more about it too, but I'll make for the same way these questions. Nothing. What is nothing?
I don't know what is nothing. Yeah, but I'm sitting here trying to bring up like a question. Right, so
my official talk title. It was really there to provoke someone to ask me. So I'm impressed. I was actually hoping that. Well, I was kind of curious. Richard and I were talking before if anyone was going to notice and say something. So you, showing that this is a very, very adept group, or at least one adept member of the group. you've managed to find me out really soon. So I can answer that question. Again, this is one of those hard answers. but usually what, so if you think of, if you looked in, so if you, what do you think, so does somebody want to propose what the typical meaning of the word nothing is? Okay, you. A lack of something, okay. What, so does something include, okay, so. Okay. So if I had a box, so if I made a box, and I put it in space, and there were no hydrogen atoms in it, and no helium atoms, no molecules, no light, no sound, because there nothing. So if I had a box, I almost used the word, but I didn't mean to say that, but pretend I didn't. If I had that box, would you say there was nothing in it? So what's in it? No, not within, like, the volume defined within. So if I had this box and I asked, so this is a physical box, you know, it's made out of whatever, fibers. Let's just say there's no gravitons going by. So that's what, okay, that's ultimately the question. Do you count space as something or nothing? Or is that not, is that part of nothing? Is empty space something or nothing? do you think of that as something or nothing?
Wouldn't the nothing be, like, beyond the universe, if there's no space
and but then, what, can you talk
about...
You could. The meaning I'm meaning is that nothing is the universe where there's nothing else but space itself. Which has a technical term, a title, which is called... This marker doesn't work. Vacuum. I think that's how you spell it. So nothing is a provocative and bad word, because you can have different meanings. So whenever this is the first, this is your first lesson in theoretical physics, which you probably, if no one else has told you this, then let me be the first. Is that the part of the goal of being a theoretical physicist is to have terms that are defined precisely and mathematically. Because what theoretical physicists do is try to define something mathematically, and then we can do things to it mathematically. That may or may not have any bearing on the real world. That's a separate question. But, so if you want to think about theoretical physics, though, you need to have a precise definition. And so that's why, as you very, what's your name?
Mm-hmm.
Yelma.
Yelma?
I have no idea how to spell that.
Y-O-M-A.
Okay, Yelma. As Yelma, which I can't pronounce, quite rightly pointed out, that nothing is a very bad term for a physicist's point of view, because I can't define it precisely. The vacuum is something I can define it precisely. And it's basically that sort of, you can call it that, state. Now I'm introducing another term that I haven't defined, that has no excitations. Where now I just have a veritable minefield of terms that I haven't defined here. But I'm not going to define them yet, because frankly, to understand the answers properly, you would have to spend a lot more time in school than 10 days theoretical physics. The point of this talk, in some ways, is to tell you that nothing can do something if nothing is defined in this way. And this is one of the great puzzles of the world of physics. I think it's one of the most puzzling facts that we know about anything, is in fact that at the present moment...
As scarlet and yellow shirt, he's not hanging in anybody.
That at the present day there is no more puzzling fact than that it appears that the vacuum of the universe, the state that the universe is in when there's nothing else around, is in fact the most dominant, the most powerful force, or doing the most sort of like surprising thing of anything else. It may seem like nothing, but it's dominating over all other causes of action in the universe. So let me try to explain why I'm making that very strident claim. So some of you may know that the universe is expanding. Does everybody here know that? Okay. So what does an expanding universe even mean? This is the point that is confusing many people. So am I and are Yamna and I at the same distance now as we were 5 minutes ago from each other. Don't get too metaphysical on me. Just answer the question. So the unit, if I say that space is expanding, is the space between me and you guys expanding right now? So who says yes? And who says no? You can't vote for both. Not everybody voted. So the rest are either not paying attention or confused or both. Watch out, if I catch you not paying attention, I will make fun of you in a pleasant way. So it turns out that the answer to that question is that we are not. We are the same distance as we were before. We're not expanding relative to each other. Because we're in a stable configuration. The Earth's gravitational field is keeping us fixed relative to each other, essentially. That's a very fancy way of saying it. But that's not, whenever we talk about the universe's expansion, it's not like everything is just getting bigger. Because sometimes people think that it's like you just have coordinates and everything is just getting bigger together. But no. Things that are bound together or stuck together by forces in the universe are really stuck together and they're not expanding anymore. So what happens in an expanding universe is that the background, the vacuum, is what's expanding. So if I just put myself in the middle of this triangular rubber sheet, and I look at how far, and I think about some point over here, and then I wait till a later time, then that same sheet bigger. Say this is a star or something, right? And that star is now farther away. And without either of us having moving at all. So the way we usually write that is that everybody's had vectors. Sorry. Try not to be confused. the arrow on top means that this is not one number but many. You'll understand soon, I promise. It's not that hard. So basically what that means is that if you have a distance between here and here, represented by x, then you can put some other number in between and you get the distance at any time. So this would be a distance from here to here at any time t. And this is a fixed number, or this is not a fixed number, but so let's just say, okay, so this is x, and this is also x. So this x is the distance between here and here measured some grid that we define on this rubber sheet. So that grid will expand with the sheet, okay? Sorry, this is a little bit confusing. And so that's the x.
This sounds like a really boring excursus, but I'm gonna use this in a minute. Just try to hang with me and we'll go back to
twisting things soon. Okay, and so, but whereas r is this real distance that's gotten bigger from the earlier time to the later time, right? So this is some other quantity that's not defined relative to the expanding sheet, but relative to some absolute standard. And so then what you could ask is that, so we know that velocity, right, is the change of position in time, right? We also know calculus. Okay, great. So we know that the chain rule means that if I take the time derivative of two functions, right, and I just get the sum of the derivatives of the two. So, I don't even want to write it. So then what I can do is just say that there's a velocity, which is the change of r in time, and that will be equal to the change in a in time times the location measured on the sheet plus this a function times the change in time measured relative to the sheet. Okay? And so we just say that since this point is fixed on the sheet, it's not moving relative to the triangle. That's zero. And x, I can just rearrange as r divided by a, right? R a x, x equals r over a. Okay? So what I can say is that this is dA over dt divided by A times R. So that the velocity of this point away from me is equal to this ratio of this A thing that I haven't told you what it is, times the initial distance. And so what that means, so the interesting thing about this is that that an object that's not moving, that it doesn't have a rocket or anything, it's just, you just dropped it there. And if it's not tied to anything else, will actually seem to have a velocity. And that velocity will be bigger depending on how far away it is from you. Okay? And this is called Hubble's law. And this was found by Hubble in the early
part of the
20th century. I
couldn't remember what his first name was.
I couldn't remember if it was Edwin or Irwin. Irwin sounded wrong. But that would have been sort of a better name. So Edwin Hubble, thank you. Sean. So see, that's so useful. Now I can call on him whenever I want. No, don't everybody feel like that. Okay, so this is Hubble's law. So this is really kind of an interesting law. And so in honor of old Edwin, they call this law that the velocity, the apparent velocity of things is h times r, where h is Hubble's constant. So he thought it was a constant, because whenever he was measuring things, they were relatively close by, only a few hundreds of light years away, short distances, you know. And so he thought there would be some universe. So he didn't really think about it very much. He was an astronomer. many of my best friends are astronomers. they know that. They understand that cosmologists don't respect it. No, I'm just joking. Anyway, so this constant, as you can see, he discovered this by looking at galaxies actually, and so he kind of noticed that, like, if you can think about if you can sort of look at things and guess how far they are away from there they are based on various aspects, right? So one obvious thing is that if you saw a person in a distance, you could tell approximately how far away they are by their apparent height, right? Like if they're little tiny, that means they're probably really far away or very short, right? But if they're really, really small, like smaller than any human could ever be, and then you know that they're in the distance, right? I mean, that's our first thing that we do to judge height. We close one eye, we can still judge how far things are based on their relative size. We know how big they are close by, right? So if they're smaller in the distance, we know how big they are in the distance, right? And we also can judge how far things are based on how loud they are or how bright they are, right? So that if you hear a faint noise, then you know that sound came from a long distance away, right? Does everyone agree with this? People seem not convinced. Watch out when you're crossing the street. Anyway, so he noticed that, so there's alternate ways of seeing how far things are away. And so he started, like, whenever he would catalog galaxies based on, like, how big they were or how bright they were, he started noticing that the ones that were farther away
tended to be redder. That is, that they were, the colors associated with the stars in the galaxies weren't the same thing
that if you looked at the spectrum of those colors,
they tended to be redder.
And so that was when he started making this law, because everyone knows what the Doppler effect is. Somebody want to define it? Doppler effect? Right. Yes. Thank you. Did everyone hear that? Can you say it louder?
If the source of a wave is moving away from you, the observer, then the frequency of the wave goes down.
Okay. Thank you. Very good. Did everyone hear that time? I'm looking at you in the back here. Could you hear what he said?
Yeah,
okay. Very good. Sorry, not to pick on you, but if I'm not going to define it, I have to make sure that everyone... Okay, so that's the double effect. And so what he did is he started inferring that there was velocities associated with distances, and there was this constant of proportionality relating velocities to distances. And again, he thought it was a constant. And it sounds like I'm belaboring this point, and I am. But this is important because if you think about it from this way, which is that, so that was back in the 19-teens. And that was actually the first evidence that the universe was expanding. You see this funny rule, and the only way anyone could think of to interpret it was that the universe itself was expanding. Does anyone know who didn't believe this, that the universe was expanding until this observation? Very good. You're all very well, very well informed about your Einstein lore. But do you know who? Did anyone name the person who predicted it before? At least one person who predicted it before it was observed. Anybody? See, this guy never gets any credit. So this guy named Georges Lemaître. I think it's. So from you, those of you from countries where they have accents in their names, you can all be proud now. So he was a Jesuit priest, and he was the first one. So he looked at Einstein's equations and he said, these equations, the universe is going to be expanding or contracting, but it can't be staying still. Which Einstein also noticed, and he thought, that's crazy talk. And so he changed his equations to make it so that they could stay still, which he later called his greatest blunder. Anyway, but Lemaître predicted it, so you should get credit. So we have this rule about the universe expanding. So whenever the universe is expanding, let's think about this H thing. So if we think about it from this standpoint, we should expect this ratio to be not a constant, right? But this should also be, in fact, a function of time, right? And so what that basically means is that if you think about the change of, if you wanted to think about sort of like, if there's a velocity, and that the velocity is changing in time, what do we call that? Acceleration, right? So if we had sort of the acceleration of the Hubble velocity, then that would basically be something like, it would end up being related to this A parameter, the second derivative of this A parameter, okay? Right? That makes sense. I mean, there'd be other terms there too. You can ignore that for now. And I should say that this A has a name, and it's called the scale factor. Okay, so just your cosmological knowledge. So whenever you go home and you're bored and you're reading papers on the internet, this is what they mean by scale factor, when they say scale factor. And this is just a note of passing that took me many years in physics before I learned that physicists have this real strange tick. But they don't like to say one, the number one. This, to all theoretical physicists, is a unity. And so that makes this very, and this is not related at all to anything except for that I think physicists are funny, is that they always say that this number approaches unity, which always cracks, to be honest, really kind of cracks me up. So people say that this, so basically you write out of people, you're only one person in the room, the number of people in the room is approaching unity. And I kid you not, people with a totally straight face will look at you and say, uh-oh, this number is going towards unity, by which they mean it's becoming one. Which, I mean, it sort of has a sort of like, we're all in it together, we're going towards unity, but they really mean this is the number one. Which relates to one more note on the funny thing about physicists not thinking about what the hell they're saying. is that there's this object in string theory that has this name, which is the P-brain. So when I was first in graduate school, I walked into a string theory talk. I sat down, and this guy, this really funny guy, he was funny not on purpose. He just came in and he said, okay, today we're going to talk about P-brains. And for an hour, P-brain this, P-brain that. And I was in the back just sort of laughing to myself. I thought, is he really serious? But he was, and he had no idea that it was funny. Anyway, so back to the story. So it turns out, and this is, so you're going to have to just go out, trust me here, but it's true, that the second derivative of the scale factor actually is one of the things that's governed by Einstein's equation. So basically, gravity sets this number. And it turns out that this number is always, can anyone guess if it's bigger or less than zero, if it's positive or negative? Well, just think about it this way. Do you think that that as time goes on, that the velocity of the universe should be slowing down or speeding up? Why do you think that? So don't mutter. Somebody raise your hands and I'll call on you.
Slow down.
Why do you think that? Yes, that is the correct answer. But somebody else said speeding up, and I want to know why. Go. But why would you think that? I mean, it is. And an excellent question it is. But
I heard somewhere that the amount of dark energy in the universe is increasing and eventually it's going to take over.
Do you have any idea what dark energy is?
It's the anti-gravitational device.
I don't have. See, I have no idea. If you know, you should tell me. Also, it's
slowing down, does that mean it's going to come to a stop?
Yeah, usually.
Yeah, but that doesn't make too much sense. Because if it comes to a stop, then you'll have a finite.
Why wouldn't that make sense? You know, I mean, before you started, I mean, you were a kid, you were walking around, you were doing whatever you did as a kid. You looked up in the sky and thought, it's going to go on forever. You just knew that intuitively? Because if you did, that's impressive.
I guess I just prefer that.
You prefer that it's going to last forever. That's good. That's fine. But to many people, that came as a surprise. No, yeah.
Well, if the net said that the universe cannot be static, and it has a velocity now of positive, if it was slowing down at some point, it would have a zero velocity.
Right, well, so it can't have a stable zero velocity. I should have been more careful with my language. But yeah, that's a good point. So the thing is, so just to tell you, so if everything we've ever observed in the universe, all kinds of matter, so basically this number is proportional to the density of stuff. This is density, like you measure in chemistry class density, like grams per cubic meter, plus 3 times the pressure. Something like that. Anyway. Anyway. So usually think of densities of things being positive, right? Like if you say this is more dense, if I said, well, you want to carry this thing that's more dense 5 hours, you want to carry this thing that's less dense 5 hours.
Probably
say the less dense thing, because you're some kind of masochist. Right? And so in pressure, I mean, you usually don't think about pressure as having a weight. It does. Turns out the pressure, it's small usually, but if there's something that doesn't have any density, like light, it can have pressure and still cause gravitational. Light does actually have density, but it's a long story. The important thing here is the positive. So there's positive numbers here, and then overall there's this negative out here. So that is to say that yes, Whoever says that we should expect that this is that the velocity slowing down was the thing that everybody expected. It's the only thing that makes sense. Everything that we know about, if you put it into Einstein's equations, if you let gravity operate, and it should slow things down, right? And it's just how gravity works. You throw things up, they don't keep going up. They stop and come back. Because gravity pulls things together. It's a purely attractive force, it seems like, right? And so that's why it's a prodigy that Yamna. Okay. Yes. It does. All the time. The pressure of light was the dominant force of energy for several thousand years. 300,000 years. The first 300,000 years of the universe existence, the pressure of light was the most dominant source of energy in the entirety. So the answer is yes. And you can see it even today if you do very sensitive measurements. Or watch science fiction shows. Those lasers knock people over like crazy. So those aren't real. Okay, so now we've established, right, that normal matter, the normal sources of gravitational stuff, or the gravitational force, should never cause the universe's expansion, which is measured by this velocity, this apparent velocity of things that are distant from us, to increase in time. Which is why it was a real surprise when, 10 years ago, we found evidence that, in fact, the universe, which, of course, you all knew was coming, some of you anticipated, that the universe's expansion is, in fact, going faster now than it was in the past. And which is probably the greatest mystery in cosmology today. So anybody have any questions at this point? About anything else, or should I keep talking about this? So I guess the question is, do you want me to talk more about, go ahead. So it's an excellent question, and it's a point that confuses. It is very confusing, but what it means is that it means that things are expanding unless something else. So it means that there's an expansion force essentially pulling things apart, but that doesn't have to be the most dominant force. In fact, almost anything is stronger. So like the Earth's gravity is pulling us down, and we're stuck. And then we're stuck here, and the electrons in our feet are pushing us up. Yeah. I mean, that's what this is basically. I mean, it's really, really weak. I mean, it's right now it's really weak. So some people speculate that at some future time that force will become the most dominant force and will rip everything apart, which would be very bad news for everybody. But it would be a long time, probably.
So this expansion force just
represents
another force?
Not quite. I hesitate to call it a force because it's not a force in the usual sense. I don't want to get bogged down in the details of it. The background, figuring out how the background of space interacts with stuff that's close together is really a complicated question. So, which you should be encouraged to study physics to understand better, but which I'm not going to be able to really exhaustively explain here.
The universe is expanding, right?
Yes.
And you said it would end by coming back.
I didn't say that, no.
Okay.
I said that was a theoretical possibility.
All right. Then possibly, is it possible when distance between gravity is different from the force of gravity is different from distance? So it's inversely proportional, right? So how is there a chance?
So it's only inversely proportional between. So that's true. That's Newtonian gravity. That's not general relativity. That the inverse force law is only true for relatively light masses separated by relatively small distances compared to the size of the universe. So the gravitational force on the universe itself doesn't have to do anything like that. doesn't even have to conserve energy. So it's really that the 1 over r squared business is it's true but misleading in the case of the whole universe. Though another long answer, but the point is that it's hard. You can't think about the background of space having a 1 over r squared dependence is hard to wrap your mind around. It works on planets really well. Planets are close together.
Oh, so if it's closer, then...
Yeah, it's really accurate for close by things, which is to say things that are not millions of light years apart.
Like, so how can you say the star can have a dark
planet? What's it? Everywhere, probably.
So everywhere is close.
It's close, but it's very diffuse. So it's not playing a big role. So and it's like if you're walking through a fog, then it's everywhere, but it's not really important, right, for your walking. Sort of like that. One more question, Nicole?
So if you're saying it's accelerating,
So the current thinking, the answer is we don't know. The current thinking is, do I have like black stuff all over my face? All right, I don't care. Can you take me seriously or should I not wipe it off? It's really bad, isn't it? Oh well, I don't really care, but I just wish my little sister were here to make fun of me. But you all are serving in her stead. I can only imagine. I'm not even going to worry about it. So the current thinking is that the universe expansion is accelerating. It's going to reach a fixed acceleration. So the velocity will continue to increase. But the acceleration rate is ramping up now to some fixed thing. But we don't know, because it's going to take a long time to get there.
So,
the acceleration is very easy. No, we don't know. It's yeah. So it's puzzling enough. I feel like I have to turn away now. This is one of the many reasons why I hate whiteboards. I think white bars are a source of evil in the universe. And if we were, this is why we should be at the front. You coming to wipe me down? What? Okay. I don't know where it is.
It's all over. Not coming off.
You're gonna have to explain this to my wife.
Okay.
Okay. I think that's the best we can do, and it's pretty good.
Okay. I'll do my best not to write any more on it. So I expect any returns you get from those photos to be expect to get at least 50% share on your Flickr affiliates program. Okay, so now that you can take me seriously again. I need to have a vote because I. I managed to see physics don't engage the entire room, but now everybody is paying attention. I'm gonna have to do this again. So we can either talk more about what could make this sort of behavior be like this, or we can talk about how we have observationally determined that this is going on. So who wants theoretical speculation? Raise your hand. And who wants observational understanding? Ooh, that's actually a close vote. You people who are more experienced, which one looked more convincing? Or should I just try to flip the time? It was about equal. So let me briefly address both. I'm going to start with observation, because in your youthful impetuosity, those of you who voted for theoretical speculation, discounted this very important thing, and I also feel like I have to make it up to the astronomers when I was insulting them. Okay, so the short story is, so as I was saying before, I can't touch my face. Again, you can tell how far, so a sphere, so the area of a sphere, of the surface of a sphere is what? Someone, you have to not mumble to yourself. If you're going to answer the question, yell it. What? Make an answer go. Sphere. The area of the surface of the sphere is... the surface of the sphere is 4 pi r squared. So this is why. This is the rule that we all have encoded in our brains. It tells us, it lets us know why sounds that are softer are generally further off, because sound waves fall off like the sphere. So those sound waves are expanding roughly spherically, and so the bigger they get, the less strong they are. So this is also true of light. So the luminosity, the brightness of an object, falls off as 1/r². And so if you could find out, okay, so you can accept that. And as I was talking about before, so any object in the universe that's basically very far away from us will also have an apparent velocity, right? So if you look at anything in the universe, and here's us, you're going to get that apparent velocity, which astronomers measure as something called redshift, which for historical reasons that I can't remember now, is called Z. Does anybody know why? Yes, go.
Other points in the universe are expanding in the same way.
We assume that they are, but we can't, it's hard to directly measure, but it seems like the universe is uniformly expanding.
About dark matter, is it increasing or is it decreasing, or is it just
I could, but it's really off. The short answer is it probably isn't decreasing, at least not very fast. But we can come to that in a second. Let me run through this. Is this related?
Yeah, well, it's about
okay. Yes, you do, but that's so. It's only always redshift if the objects aren't, if they're not, if it's only the background expansion that's doing anything. So, but if you had a, if I took a light bulb, if I took a flashlight and threw it at you from, like, say, Mars, it would be coming towards you even though the universe is expanding, right? And so it would seem to be blue shift. And so the same thing can happen. If you have two close by galaxies, they can be coming towards each other. And so the light will seem to be blue shifted, or it will be blue shifted. But if not, that's because something else is going on. But if you get far enough out, then the redshift will control it. Okay, so I'm going to do this really fast. I want to leave open time for questions like that. It's a good question, but I just want to finish the story real fast. Is that okay? Anyway, so you have a redshift, which basically, so redshift comes from this law, and this is time. So what redshift basically tells you is when, in the universe's history, an object is observed. And then you also see how bright it is, right? So you see also the luminosity, which tells you, through this rule, if you know how bright something was whenever it existed, like if you had a standard 100-watt bulb 10 billion years ago, you can see it. You know intrinsically how bright it is. Then you could use this rule to figure out how far it is, like in ruler units, right? So then you'd have R and T. And if you could do this for a lot of different objects, right, then you could have something that looked like this. So you'd have R and T, and you have some line, and then you could also, so you could work out how fast the R is, and you change it to T. That should be your velocity. That'd be how fast the expansion rate was going. And then you could also work out the change of R over change of T, the change of T. And so the really cool thing about this, how this is done is because there's a certain class of exploding stars. They're called type 1a supernovae, which you should read more about for yourselves. But basically, it's a ball of carbon. Mainly carbon. Is it Does anybody remember? I think it's carbon mainly, but I can't remember. Anyway, so one, I think it's mainly carbon. It's about the size of our sun. And this ball of carbon is so condensed that the only thing that's supporting it is basically the fact that in chemistry, you know that like in hydrogen, spin up and spin down electrons, you can only have one spin up and one spin down electron, like in the first energy level of hydrogen, right? Everybody remember that? So that's called, and the thing that keeps another one from going in is called electron degeneracy pressure. So basically, it's just the fact that electrons are quantum mechanical things. And so type 1a supernovae, our entire star is where the dominant source of force is that. It's the fact that electrons push each other away. Like if you put a spin up and a spin down electron by each other, they're happy. If you try to put anything else there, it pushes it back. And so this is an entire star the size of our sun or bigger that's just supported by that. So if you put, but there's a limit to how big those can get. And if you go over that limit, then the entire star spontaneously explodes. It's really bright. And but because there's a universal, because we assume that the laws of physics are universal, then basically that explosion is about the same brightness everywhere in the universe, and no matter when it happens, because it's always the same rules, and there's always the same mass that it gets to before it blows up, and it always blows up in more or less the same way. You notice I'm hedging my bets here a little bit, but that's a long story. Anyway, so and this is an important thing because even though to you,
you don't know a lot about astronomy,
and it sounds like, okay, supernova, whatever, big deal. There's almost nothing in the universe that we know the intrinsic brightness of. And so it's a really big deal that there's any object at all that you can intrinsic, you can just look at it and say, oh, it's not supernova or supernova. It's probably that bright. It's really amazing that you can do this. Anyway, so once you have this, and then you observe one, then that means you get this, and then you can measure its redshift, which means you have the time, which allows you to construct this law. And it's the observation of those kind of supernovae that gave us the first direct evidence that the universe's expansion was accelerating. So, that's the observational part in 5 minutes, not bad. So now I can give you a brief tour of the theoretical speculations about what's causing this. I talked
at the beginning about this vacuum. So
the one piece of
intuition that we have that kind of pushes us in the right direction for thinking about what's causing universes to expand, accelerate these expansions
is just think about this. So if you have a taut string or like the internal the tension on a rubber sheet, right? But it seems like that. So if you had a tense rubber sheet, that seems like we have an intuition that a tension is something that pushes out, right, rather than pulling in. So even though, like you know that you, if you you're like pulling on a string, that it's a pull. Tension is a word that we have. It's a kind of force that tugs out. Right? And so it turns out that if you have objects that are in the universe that have something that is analogous to tension, like a string tension or the tension in a rubber sheet, then those kind of objects have this funny property that whenever you have their density is positive. The energy density, it turns out, is always positive. But their pressure is negative. So negative pressure is that property that of like pushing out that we have a sort of intuitive grasp on for something that has tension, right? Think of a taut sheet. Sort of seems like it's pushing out. So there really could be things that have this pushing out pressure. And so there's basically three, so we have a three-dimensional universe, right? More or less, at least three. And so there are basically three things that could have that kind of pressure. It would be lines, sheets, or basically the universe itself, like the background of the universe itself could have a tension. And so basically, the pressure for a string is equal to minus one third of the density of a string. It turns out for these kind of universe, if you just had a straight line in space of some kind of energy density, and for a sheet, it's equal to minus two thirds. And for space itself, it's exactly equal and opposite. And since the thing that goes into the rule is rho plus minus rho plus three times pressure, then any of these, these two at least, can cause the universe to accelerate. And so this is an old idea, basically, that and this one in particular, because it has this funny balance, that there's no reason, and it turns out that this means that in Einstein's equations, which I can write for you, so that's what Einstein's equations look like. You should be amazed, but maybe you already all knew that. So it turns out that you can always this is the general form of Einstein's equations, where this is basically space curves, and this is matter and energy. And because of this form, these mu's and nu's tells you basically 0, 1, 2, 3, or time, that way, and that way. Because of this form, you can always just add some other term and then multiply it by some other. This is a 4x4 matrix of numbers you can learn about later. Not today. Anyway, and you can just put some constant in. And so this, if you just put a constant in like this, it has exactly the same physical properties as saying that the pressure is equal to the opposite of the density. And so in this form of the equations, then you can always put this constant in, which is called the cosmological constant. And it looks like it's a tension in space. And so there's really no reason it shouldn't be there. And so then the question becomes, so is it there? And then we say, well, we have these observations, so it is there. So then you say, okay, well, how big is it? And so then the answer of how big it is then becomes a long answer, because you can try to guess. I mean, so you can try to do calculations. So the thing is, if you have a tension in space, so the best guess for what causes the tension of the background of space is all the stuff in. So it turns out, you'll just have to believe me here, that that we believe that the vacuum of space, physicists believe this, is swimming with particles, just that they come into and out of and go out of existence. It's called quantum. This is essentially what is meant by quantum field theory, which is a term you may have heard before. And so basically, the assertion is that the tension of space is the energy caused by the particles that spring into existence and then annihilate. And so if that's true, then basically the density of space, of the background of space, or the vacuum, let me say, should be about equal to the mass of the stuff in space divided by the separation between the things cubed. And so if you do this, you can do this calculation. You can estimate what this should be using our knowledge of quantum field theory. And then if you take the observed value that we got from doing these supernova measurements, and you divide it by the calculation, you get an answer that is 10 to the minus power 121. Which is to say that we have no idea what we're doing when we're calculating this. And so this is the great puzzle that's known as the cosmological constant. problem. And most people believe that this background energy must be the cause of this funny thing, but we don't know why we're getting such a wrong answer when we do our calculations. So that's pretty much the state of knowledge on this. The people have ideas, but none of them work. So with that, I'm going to stop my formal presentation and just take questions for the remaining time. So you had what was your question again? Something about dark matter? I think you asked if dark matter was increasing.
Oh, right.
So did y'all learn about dark matter in some other sessions? Okay, so dark matter. So this generally goes into all of this stuff I've been talking about. Whenever physicists started needing to get grants to study this, they came up with a cooler name than cosmological constant, which is to say dark energy. Dark energy is the new guy on the block. And so dark matter was there way before. Dark matter was dark before dark energy was cool. But it had a very bad, unmarketable name first, too, which was missing mass, which caused people to ignore it for years. If it was missing mass, you can find it. If it's dark matter, you found it, but it's cool. Anyway, so dark matter, so I think the question was, is dark matter increasing in time? And so we don't know what it is, so we can't say, is the short answer. But most people expect that it's not decreasing in time anymore. Because if we know anything about dark matter, is that it's not doing much other than gravitate. I don't know for a fact that it's increasing, but it can't be increasing very fast. We certainly know of no ways for it to increase.
So how would it be able to pull back and accelerate?
Well, there's a lot of it to start with, but it's not going to. But the acceleration is winning anyway.
So there's less chance
for it. There's nothing. We don't know of any way for the amount of matter to increase in time. So it's we do actually, yeah. But they're not very efficient ways. It turns out that the current state of what cosmologists think is that the very, very, very early universe, the first instance of the universe, that were dominated. That we went through a phase like this dark energy phase before, where the universe was expanding at accelerated rates. That's called inflation. And that's a whole other story. Anyway, but we know that if that's true, we started out like that, and then we got a whole lot of dark matter. And so it's in principle possible to go from accelerated expansion to generating dark matter. So it's possible to turn, energy that's causing expansion to acceleration into matter. That is possible. But we still don't really know how that happened then, and so it's hard to say whether it could happen again. And we know that this is a different kind of phenomenon, because this is really, really high energy and this is low energy. So other questions? Yeah.
So is that what you're thinking is going to happen to kind of bring the acceleration
to a constant? So the acceleration goes to constant by default. It's just that's what it does. If you just put in this into the equation, then this number is a constant. And so whenever this wins, and this is completely dominant, then this number is a constant, and the acceleration rate, or this number is on a constant, rather, the in some sense, the time rate of change of that number. No, that's right. This number becomes a constant. But, well, it's a long story. But essentially, the acceleration rate goes to a constant. No, once this starts dominating, it's like the dark side of the force in Star Wars. Once you've started down that path, then this. Other questions? From someone who hasn't asked a question. Or all of you too. Shell-shocked by laughing at me having stuff all over my face. So you surely must have some question about the universe. I know everything about the entire universe, so.
Like a question, and there's always a
That's correct. For about 300,000 years, approximately. So it just turns out that, I don't know how to tell you this. It just turns out that that's how things are. Yeah. So basically, what you can do is you can look back into the history of the universe and infer that whenever the so we have hydrogen and helium now in the universe. So if we look out into the universe, there's about 3/4 hydrogen and 1/4 helium. And so because of that turns out to be a very interesting number, because that tells you how fast the universe was expanding about 3 minutes after the Big Bang. And so if you put that expansion rate into Einstein's equations, what you find is that the kind of energy that makes the expansion rate that is radiation. So you know that the radiation was dominating the universe's expansion 3 minutes after the Big Bang. And then you can do similar kinds of checks at other times. And you can then infer how much radiation there is. So we know approximately how much energy is in radiation in the whole universe. It's kind of a cool fact. Other questions? Why does it not what? Yeah. So dark matter. Yeah. So dark energy cheats, basically. So you think of density as mass divided by length cubed, right? And so most of the time you think of this as being a fixed number, right? And so if you have an expanding universe, this is growing, right? So that means that rho over time shrinks, right? So that means that, and so then it's just a question of what shrinks the most slowly. It turns out radiation shrinks faster than matter, which is why radiation used to dominate, then matter dominated. But dark energy cheats. Because it's the tension of space itself, if that's really what it is, then the rho of dark energy, or of lambda, has essentially a mass that's fixed, and a length, and this is the part that's weird, is also fixed. So basically, because it's the tension of the background of space, as space expands, you just get more. So the more space is, then the bigger the amount of background energy as a density just stays constant. So just you double the size of the universe, you have double the amount of dark energy. It's crazy, but it turns out that cosmology doesn't respect the conservation of energy at all. So. I know you learned it in school, but it's not true.
What do you mean by the size of the universe?
The size of the universe. Okay, that's, yeah, you call me. So what I really mean is this, so the scale factor, A, so whatever A increases by a factor of 2, whatever the, yeah, that's usually the, whenever we say size, we really mean the sort of like the scale factor, which you always have to normalize to some time. Yeah. Just coming out of wherever, nowhere. Yeah, I know, it's very strange. This is why people find this very troubling. Do you have an estimate? No. So because conservation of energy is just false when it comes to gravity. The reason why, I should say, I'm saying this a little bit glibly, but so gravity itself is a very puzzling force, because in some ways, it's just, whenever you're describing the whole universe, conservation of energy is not respected. But the thing I should be saying is that the definition of energy is non-existent. For a universe, to go back to the original question that you asked about whether there's only one universe, We don't know how to define how much energy there is in the universe. That is just a question we can't. That's an answer we don't. Amount of energy in the universe equals have no idea. And so you can't even form the question of is energy then being conserved, because it's you can't even ask the question of what the energy is. So then to find out whether the it's changing is ill-formed. And so it's a bit confusing. But it's not getting turned. But nothing in the universe, nothing that we see is getting turned into this stuff. It's just popping up. We don't know. We can only see a finite amount. We can see 14 billion light years in every direction because that's how old the universe is, and that's pretty much all we know. So dark matter is basically, this is the difference between dark matter and dark energy. Dark matter, basically, as the universe gets bigger, decreases in density. Dark energy is that stuff that as the universe gets bigger, its density stays the same. Dark energy is. So dark energy doesn't dilute with expansion. It stays the same. It's just so it's like if you had a jar of coins, and you got a jar that was twice as big, and you had twice as many coins.
Are we by any chance affected by dark energy right now?
The density is extremely low, and there is it has no known direct influence on anything. So somebody, yes, you have noticed. Which kind of energy? So this is again one of these puzzles. So gravity is really the only way that we can violate this conservation of energy. Like the rest of the physical laws we have more or less respect the conservation of energy. So to generate energy, you have to basically be outside of a universe. So you'd have to make a universe, and then you could pull energy out of it. But then we can't make a universe because we're in the universe, right? So it's not. So even though, like on the biggest scale, like the universe itself is sort of like your parents, right? They can break the rules, but you can't. So the universe can break this energy rule, but when you live inside the universe, you're kind of like stuck with this conservation of energy. So somebody has enough.
Right now, they think that the universe has a curvature.
So the universe's curvature is an interesting question. So let me just say for a second. So something I haven't talked about with all this talk about the universe is that we also have this phenomenon of the universe having a geometry, which is basically the question of the geometry of the universe is, if I draw that shape and I say there's three angles here, and I ask the question, what is the sum of those three angles? And there's three possible, there's an infinity of possible answers. 180 degrees is the thing that we learn in Euclidean geometry, and that's for flat space. There is no guarantee that your space respects that. There's no, that permits almost any answer to that question. So if we, the geometry of space tells us what the angular, the sum of the angles of triangles are. Turns out our space is almost precisely flat. But the Euclidean geometry is a very, 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 very good approximation for us. So we can measure it to about 1% accuracy on the biggest scale, and we see no evidence the space is anything but flat. But in principle, space could be curved. And so space on the longest scale could be curved. And it's
also true
that gravity works by causing space to curve. And so in the vicinity of the Earth, this triangles are slightly not 180 degrees. In fact, they're so close we can't measure it. But you got really close to a black hole in some sense, and you could start distorting this law. Or not law, but you start getting wrong answers for this. Okay, so another question? So, yeah, it's fine.
I just was wondering about how it travels from a point in the universe. It travels, by the time you get back to where you started.
That is not probably true.
Is there an edge?
So, let me ask you a question. Is there an edge to the surface of a ball? if you're on the surface of the ball, is there an edge? Yeah, so that's, yeah, so it could be. So the question, so that, the reason I ask it, frame it that way, is that it sets you up to ask the right question, which is, if there's only three dimensions, there's no evidence that we're not just on the surface of some ball. And it could be a ball like a ball that we know that we have. But there's another kind of surface. So basically, it would be infinite and flat, which is kind of weird. Infinite and like a ball, which is to say closed, in which case, if you went far enough, you could get back to where you started. They're not in finite, not in a finite amount of time, unless it was static. Or it can be infinite and open, which is to say that the shape of the universe, well, I can't really draw it. It sort of looks like a saddle. You know what a saddle looks like? Yeah, anyway, so that's that hyperboloid shape. And so that would be the surfaces of constant time or distance, would be like that. So those are the three possibilities. Only the closed one can you get back to where you started by going in one direction. And there's no evidence that if the universe is closed, which it could be, there's no evidence that we have no idea about how big that ball would be. Any more questions? I don't think I have one more minute, so. For the dark matter problems? I haven't seen any that work fully consistently. And we have very good reasons to expect that there should be something like dark matter coming out of our theories of particle physics. And so I think that my suspicion, which is shared by many people, is that there really is some extra particle that's causing these missing mass phenomena. So it could be that I'm wrong. But the thing is that if there is a theory of gravity that explains it, it would have to basically be a theory of gravity that made something that looked a heck of a lot like a particle. So it couldn't be gravity in the traditional sense that we usually think of it. It would have to be gravity that does something that looks a whole lot like a particle, in which case it becomes like a slightly funny game of like whether you call that gravity. Okay, I think I'm out of time. Thanks a lot.